This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we are slated to hear from columnist Smiley Anders of the Baton Rouge Advocate, celebrating his birthday with us. Zia Tamami, the local jazz authority, is here to talk about jazz in our community after the death of Derek Gordon in a major event tonight. Also, biographer Walter Starr, his latest target is Seward, Lincoln's indispensable man. And we'll hear from Van Mayhall on the remarkable life and times of Judas the Apostle, the provocative work from a local writer. All this today, but first the news on 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, and we begin with biographer Walter Starr. He's the author of the well-received John Jay Founding Father, a graduate of Stanford and Harvard Law. He practiced international law for 25 years, and he has now become a significant writer, and his latest work is Seward, Lincoln's Indispensable Man, a compelling story about one of the more remarkable people in the 19th century. And good morning to you, Walter Starr.
Good morning.
Well, with the film that is a hit right now, Out and About, Lincoln, I guess Seward's influence and involvement with Abraham Lincoln has become even more well-known.
Indeed. I think the film does a great job of capturing the relationship between the two men that they, you know, relied on one another to an extent that they could argue with one another.
He was the chief rival to President Lincoln, according to the fine historian Doris Kearns Goodwin. How did that relationship evolve over time?
Well, he was the odds-on favorite to become the Republican nominee in 1860, and people, including Seward and Lincoln, were surprised that Lincoln got the nomination. But Seward then turns around and does a surprising thing. He campaigns for Lincoln. At the time, candidates didn't campaign for themselves. They relied on friends, and no friend was more important in that process than Seward. So it wasn't a complete surprise. It was expected when Lincoln offered Seward the position of Secretary of State. They didn't know one another well. They'd only met a couple times when Lincoln arrived in Washington just before the inauguration. And at first there were some issues because Seward expected that given his vast experience and position in the party that Lincoln would defer to him. But once they got to know one another well, they liked one another and worked together very well.
Well, he was almost killed the night that Abraham Lincoln was assassinated, correct?
Yes, that's right. And I sort of wish the movie had touched on that point because I think it helps to cement, in a way, the closeness of their relationship and his importance, because Booth targeted Seward, believing that if he succeeded in killing Lincoln, that Seward would sort of take over as kind of de facto president, and so he wanted to get Seward out of the way as well, and nearly did.
What happened that night?
Two of the assassins working with Booth came to Seward's house. One stayed outside with the horses, and one knocked on the door, and through a combination of words and violence, made his way into Seward's bedroom. He had used a pistol to club Seward's son to near death outside the door. So his pistol wasn't working, but his backup plan, his knife, was working quite well, a 6-inch Bowie knife. Pressed Seward into his bed and slashed down several times with the knife, missed once, but slashed into Seward's face and neck several times, leaving him bleeding profusely near death. A miracle that Seward survived.
Considering his role in the Civil War as the Secretary of State, how significant was Seward's contributions during that war?
I think they were quite important. Maybe I'm a little biased, but you know, the American Revolution was in a sense won when France recognized the United States and agreed to provide military assistance. And Seward knew that history. The Confederates knew that history. The Confederates were keen to get help from England and France, and they knew that if they got that, that in some form, maybe not with its complete territory, but with some territory, the Confederacy would survive. And Seward placed pressure both in Washington and through our ministers in Europe, not just in Britain and France, but in other nations, on those key nations to stay out. And he also handled some delicate issues when the northern blockade of the southern ports led to controversies between the North and Britain and France, including one in late 1861, the Trent Incident, that looked at the time like it was almost sure to lead to war between Britain and the United States.
He was a social animal, wasn't he?
Indeed. And it's wonderful to see him in the movie with his cigar and his glass of brandy, and he almost never, during the course of the Civil War, dined alone with his family. He either dined out or, more often, had guests into his house, sometimes small dinners, often large gatherings reported in the newspapers, and you know, reveled in one-on-one friendships with Lincoln, other members of the cabinet, military officers, leading actors. Edwin Booth, the older brother of John Wilkes Booth, was a dinner guest from Tarrant House, along with other actors from time to time.
He died in 1872. Was Seward Place a happy man when he departed the world?
Well, I think if he had his druthers, like most, he would have stayed on for a few more years. But yes, I think he was pleased at what he had accomplished, especially the aid of the States between the Union together, but also purchasing Alaska, making some other late aid purchases, which didn't come to pass in his lifetime, but he hoped and expected would come to pass.
He was a
man with a very long view. He, for example, purchased Alaska in part because he thought the Pacific would prove more important to the United States than the Atlantic, and that trade with Asia would be, in 100 years perhaps, more important than trade with Europe. And so it has proved.
Well, William Henry Seward was definitely one of the most important Americans of the 19th century. He was governor of New York. He was a prominent U.S. senator. Why did he lose, or how did he lose the 1860 presidential election to Abraham Lincoln?
There are a variety of explanations ranging from the small to the large. On the small scale, the convention was held in Chicago, and Lincoln's friends arranged the seating in a way that disadvantaged Seward, sort of preventing the Seward delegates from getting to the undecided delegates at critical moments. On the larger front, Seward was, from the days of his governorship, known as a friend of the dispossessed, the blacks, the Catholic immigrants. There were, within the Republican Party at the time, a lot of anti-Catholics, and there was concern, legitimate concern in a way, that Seward as nominee couldn't carry states like Pennsylvania and New Jersey, and the Republicans, keen to win, nominated a man with less of a track record on those issues, Lincoln, than Seward. And Seward, in a couple of comments, suggests that he understood. You know, he said once to a friend that, you know, political parties have to nominate candidates who can win, and there were problems with my candidacy, and Lincoln was a good choice.
Well, the book is Seward, Lincoln's Indispensable Man, from Walter Starr, who has emerged as one of the country's foremost biographers and historians, and we compliment you and thank you for joining us today to talk about this amazing man, William Henry Seward.
Thanks for having me with you.
Thank you, sir. Take care.
Bye.
And congrats. And we're joined now by Smiley Anders, the venerable columnist for the Baton Rouge Advocate, graduate of LSU in 1959, master's in journalism 1971, member of the Manship Hall of Fame, and for 33 years, a columnist whose work appears on the front page of Section B 6 days a week, and today is Smiley's birthday. Happy birthday, Smiley Anders.
Venerable is the word, I think. So, thank you, Jim, and thanks for the gift. I didn't know you knew I like single malt scotch. I thought that was very nice.
Well,
really appreciate it.
Smiley Anders is quite a man, and he's been doing what he does for a very long time. But before those 33 years of column writing that we've read each day almost for the last 33 years, you were involved as a tough, tenacious reporter, right?
Oh, I did. I covered business news, and it was interesting. I was doing the oil crisis in '73, and a lot of the things going on there. I was at a very interesting time covering business, and really enjoyed it. I thought that was what my career was going to be, and then the column came along, and we did it as an experiment, and we're going to see if it works, and we'll keep doing it.
Well, among Smiley's assignments, he was the information director for the Louisiana Farm Bureau for 4 years.
Yeah.
And before that, right out of college, you were oil and gas editor of the Shreveport Times. What did the oil and gas editor for the Shreveport Times do?
We had a lot of small wells up that way, a lot of wildcatters, really interesting guys. Not any great big wells, but there was a lot going on up there, and a lot of self-made millionaires in the oil fields in Texas and Arkansas. We covered east Texas and southern Arkansas. So there was a lot going on. I had only been there a couple of weeks doing general assignment, and the oil editor was moved up to the editorial desk, and they kind of looked around the newsroom, and I was the least busy, being the newest, and so they came over and informed me I was oil and gas editor. The fact I knew nothing about the oil and gas industry didn't seem to bother them, and I tried to learn on the fly.
Well, he joined The Advocate in 1973 as the first business reporter, and he started the column in 1979, November 4th, right? Or no, it was June 4th. November 4th was the hostage taking.
Yeah, right.
No, June 4th.
The other tragedy.
Yeah, which happened 5 months after Smiley started writing his column. Mm-hmm. And of course, you have ebbed and flowed with the news through that time to the current. There have been some amazing times in this community in the last three and a half decades.
Absolutely. We've had some. And of course, mine is very light, lightly sort of. So I don't really do politics or anything like that. But I try to give everybody a chance to tell their story. Everybody's got at least one good story in them, and we try to put as many of those out as we can.
Well, there are many stories that happen in newsrooms that are developed there, and then there are stories that occur in bar rooms. And Smiley, through the years, has been known to frequent watering holes in this community.
Yes, I get a lot of stories written on cocktail napkins, and I try to keep them dry so I can read them the next morning.
Sometimes I'll see the mayor of the city in the same room with Smiley Anders.
Oh, yeah, the Kipster. Yeah, oh, yeah.
Who got 60% of the votes a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
How do you explain his success?
I think he's just a likable guy, you know. And I think he's one of those that kind of transcends politics. I think, evidently, people just genuinely like him. He's, you know, pleasant. He shows up everywhere. Always said, I think he's cloned because he's always around.
The ubiquitous Melvin Kip Holden and the venerable Smiley Gray Anders, born on this date in 1937 in Natchez. We'll be back in 1 minute with Smiley. This is Jim Inkster, and you are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Our guest is Smiley Anders. His latest work, by the way, is Smiling, Smiley, A Laughing Matter. You make people laugh.
I hope so. At least a chortle, or, you know, I'll settle for a grin, you know, whatever.
Well, where do you find this stuff?
Everywhere. Like I said, everybody's got a story, and they, and, you know, since we moved to New Orleans, I've got a whole new bunch of contributors now that have just started writing in on a regular basis, from Kenner and Harvey, Marrero, and, of course, New Orleans itself.
Right. You didn't move to New Orleans, but the Baton Rouge Advocate is now in New Orleans.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
And I saw your boss the other night, and Mr. Manship. He told me you had 20,000 subscribers, something like that.
Is that right? It was 11,000 last I heard, so it's growing.
Yeah, and here's your gift, by the way.
Oh, you are kidding. Oh, Jim, I really didn't. How the heck did you do that? Do I have to give it back when the show's over?
No, it's yours. You just have to share.
Well, bless your heart. You are.
But we don't start early in the morning with that stuff, though.
I take back all the bad stuff I've ever said about you.
Well, 75 years old. Yeah. You've seen some stuff in your day, Smiley Anders.
I can't believe it. I mean, I don't feel 75. I mean, my wife says I'm still childish, so I guess that helps it.
Well, you have commented that your marriage to the lovely Lady Catherine started as a friendship.
Yeah, she lived across the street. She was a Spanish Town neighbor, and we got together one Christmas, as a matter of fact, and been together ever since.
You said you were holding hands and you didn't even realize it.
Yeah, we were sitting on the porch. We'd had dinner. We cooked steaks for Christmas dinner. We were both by ourselves, both divorced, and just happened. We're out on the porch in the afternoon watching the sun go down, and wham! It just hit us.
Now, your office now is on beautiful Bluebonnet Boulevard.
Yeah, in the Jimmy Swaggart complex. So,
did you like 3rd Street or Lafayette Street better?
I miss it every day. Of course, they didn't ask me about moving, but I love being downtown. Of course, I live in Spanish Town, and I could walk to work. Not that I ever did, but I could have. And it was kind of neat being downtown.
297-5633 or 877-217-5757 if you have the inclination to join us and talk with Smiley on his birthday. And many folks at your stage of your career would say, hey, I've had enough, time to go. But Smiley, you're just getting started, aren't you?
Oh, yeah. Well, I always quote David Manship when he asked him about retiring, and he said, retire from what? So that's kind of the way I feel. I mean, I love what I'm doing, and so as long as I'm upright, I think I can do it.
In this national organization that you're affiliated with, six times, right? Isn't it six times you've been named Columnist of the Year?
Five times. Yeah, it was in the items category. They have
a Herb Cain
Award. It was named after Herb Cain, who was an items columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle and just kind of a legendary figure. And so they named the award for him, and I got it, I think, five. It might have been six. I don't know.
Well, sometimes columns like yours fly in a community, and other times they're duds. But I'm told by your handlers that your column is the most read part of the newspaper. When you're not there, people are concerned.
Yeah, I'm going on vacation next week, and I'm going to have some people griping at me for going on vacation, which I guess is okay. It's nice to be missed. I'd rather that than they, you know, didn't know I was gone.
So you now get more material than ever, considering this new audience that you have in New Orleans. How do you decide what makes the cut, Smiley?
Yeah, well, I try to get a mix of stuff. I don't want all, you know, nostalgia items. I want a few of those, some jokes, some good deeds that people do. I do a lot of that kind of stuff. just some things about charitable events going on in the community, and a few little jokes at the end. And I just kind of stir it around and until I get the mix I want. And of course, now with email, it's so easy. I can store stuff and change stuff around, drop things in, and, you know, really play with it. And I get almost everything by email now.
So everything by email?
Almost about 95%.
Do you miss
a few letters, a few phone calls, but that's a few bar conversations.
Yeah. You miss the old days?
Yeah, I kind of. It was a little more colorful back then. We were probably a little more self-destructive too, though, but we were kind of, it was a little crazier. Things have calmed down a lot in the news business.
297-5633. Smiley Anders with us for a bit longer. Todd, listening at WRKF.org in Seattle, wants to know about your thoughts regarding the election of 2 weeks ago. Were you surprised?
I was surprised at the magnitude. Yeah, I thought it was going to come out the way it did, but I didn't think it was going to be quite as large a gap as it was. And of course, I don't usually discuss, you know, politics in the column, but I have some views, but I just don't want to alienate half of the readers by
expressing those
views.
So this is your opportunity.
Yeah. So, it was not a surprise to me, and it was I just kind of sized up the way things were going. And,
well, when you went to LSU in late 50s, early 60s, you graduated when, 60?
59.
Yeah. School was all white.
All white.
Football
yeah.
team, obviously, all yeah. white.
The basketball team was all white.
The whole school. There weren't any blacks on campus unless they were working.
Yeah, right.
So are you surprised that here we are, 2012, Smiley's still covering the news, half century later, a little more than a half century, and the football team is almost 80% black. Yeah. We've got an African-American president of the United States and a black mayor of Baton Rouge.
Yeah, you have to feel good about, you know, the way things are going. You can get down on the people for a lot of things, but in the long haul, it looks like we are becoming a diverse nation finally, and it's taken a long time, but I guess I'm an optimist about it. But it is getting bad. We can consider how far we came. We have done well.
And Smiley has not shied from tough stories along the way, and he has gone places where few reporters have gone. You even went to a nudist camp at one point.
Yes, in the interest of journalism. I bared it all, and it was interesting. I was doing a thing for Baton Rouge Magazine, and Norman Ferracci, the editor, wanted me to do some investigative stuff, but kind of lighthearted, in a lighthearted way. So I investigated a nudist colony to get at the naked truth and the bare facts, and as it were. So,
this was in Slidell?
Outside of Slidell. It might still be there. I don't know.
I think it still is.
Indian Hills. They call it very nice. Yeah, very nice people. And
But I'm told that you arrived in similarly dressed as you are today, very patriotic, red tie and a blue shirt and a red vest, and people were looking at you kind of strange.
Oh, yeah, until I took my clothes off, then nobody noticed me. After that, it was kind of discouraging. But
well, we're in a city that sometimes doesn't reward characters like you. Sometimes characters pay a price for their unique perspective on life. How have you been able to do it?
I just kind of been myself, and I never had any instructions on how to do the column. They said, one of the editors said, we want to get a lot of names in and let everybody tell their story, and they should be able to get in the Advocate without dying or holding up a Circle K. So that's kind of been my, what I've been guided by. And I mostly let the radios tell their their stories. I try not to intrude, you know, too much.
Beth downtown asks where you hung out downtown back in the 60s and 70s. What was hot in those in that time?
Oh, I don't know. Pastime, Footily, some of the ones that are still around.
What was that place on Laurel Street?
Laurel Street. Let's see. Chris's Bar on 19th Street was a great place.
They had the fish bowls there, right?
The fish bowls of beer, red beans and rice on Wednesday. They even had an oyster bar at one time. It was a neat pool table.
When I say a fish bowl, they serve beer in a fish bowl. So if you drank a couple of those, you were in no condition to drive.
Right, right. So that was...
It helped to live nearby, didn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Well, as a matter of fact, I did. I always lived in and around Spanish Town. So,
well, another listener asks about your passion for a loop in the city. That's one that has drawn some fire from some of your avid readers, right?
Yeah,
you took after one.
A guy called me an idiot the other day. It's one of the only times somebody that wasn't kin to me has called me an idiot. So the people who live out. Really have resisted the idea of a loop. And so he even said, well, you know, what if you had a highway coming by your house? And I said, well, actually, I have Interstate 110 coming by my house. So you do get used to it. But I don't know if we'll ever get one or not. I just think it's I get stuck in traffic so much that it seems like it would be a good idea.
Now, another listener asks about your opinion regarding the legalization of marijuana in some states.
Well, I think it's coming. I think it will be one of the last, but I think that for small amounts, for personal use, it's kind of hard to lock somebody up for something like that. I mean, if you're selling, like bales of it, maybe. But
what about what the honey badger did in Jordan Jefferson? They had a perp walk and public humiliation.
I understand they had rather a large amount, still, I don't know. I'm not sure it was bad judgment on his part, but I'm not sure the. Penalty fit the crime. Of course, I don't really have all the right. details. He might have been doing a lot of other stuff.
Same-sex marriage, that's something that seems to be picking up traction in this country.
That's coming, too. We'll be the last ones to do all that stuff, but I think nationwide we'll see state after state, falling in line over the years. It'll be slow, just like the integration thing was. It didn't happen in a day or a week or a year, a decade, but it's coming.
Okay. Lou downtown asks if the Laurel Street place, the Brunswick?
The Brunswick. Oh, yeah. How can I forget the Brunswick? Mm-hmm. I learned how to shoot poo. Actually, I learned how to shoot poo at the Y, but I enhanced my game at the Brunswick. And as I recall, great hamburgers and chicken and dumplings and great lunch place.
And there have been a few places to come and go, but Smiley has managed to outlive just about everybody. Pastime's still going, though.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, the Pastime is still there. I visit there, but not as often as you visit Lewis, but I visit it once a week or so.
Well, we're glad you're doing what you do. Smiley,
well,
Ray
thanks.
Andrews, happy birthday to you, and hope you enjoy your
I'm
gift.
Really embarrassed about the gift. Thank you, though.
Thank you, sir.
Okay.
And good to see you as always. Keep up the good work. And you'll be riding throughout the week, I'm sure.
Oh, absolutely.
Thanksgiving Day. Smiling to be there.
Yeah, I always do. Yeah.
All right. So
all right.
We move from one institution to another. Smiley Gray Anders is now making way for Zia the Cat, Zia Tamami, the foremost jazz authority, and this community, and one of the top jazz men in the world is Zia Tamami. Good morning to you, Zia.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. So
good to be with you.
Tonight's a big night, right?
Very big. Chucho Valdez, he's coming from a very sort of a special family from Cuba. He is, you can say that he is Marcellus of Cuba. His father was a legend, pianist, Bebo. His son is a legend. And then he started a wonderful band in the late 70s called Iraquere. And they came on behalf of the State Department to U.S. And two of his best players, they defected to U.S. And one is Arturo Sandoval, and the other one is Paquito de Rivera, which we brought last year to Baton Rouge. So tonight he's going to be there with his seven-piece band. And this is very special occasion to see him live on stage.
He's won 5 Grammy Awards and 3 Latin Grammy Awards.
Exactly.
Chucho Valdez, tonight, you said there. Where is there?
Well, at Manship Theater, which, as you guys know, this is the best place to see jazz. Seats around 300, 350 people, and very nice setting. And 7 o'clock and 9 o'clock shows at Manship Theater. Tickets are still available. And we're very excited to have this wonderful combo. And he's going to be with his big band. He refers to Afro-Cubano Messengers.
Well, we'll talk with Zia about jazz in this community as we move along and spend a bit more time with him. But let's hear a bit from Chucho. Now, Chucho will be at the Manship Theater tonight, 2 shows, 7 p.m., 9 p.m. He's part of a series of some great artists who've appeared at the Manship Theater over the last few years.
In 6 years, Jim, and this is something for our listeners out there to know. One of my dear colleagues is legendary promoter of Nat King Cole, among others, Dick LaPalme, who was A&R manager of Chess Label, where they recorded, you know, from Muddy Waters all the way to Ramsey Lewis. He is in L.A., and he's telling me that he heard about our group, River City Jazz Coalition. They're talking about us in New York. For a little bitty town like Baton Rouge to have this kind of a venue, going from Kenny Barron to Ahmad Jamal to Ramsey Lewis to...
Okay,
all
hold
these legends,
that thought.
It's incredible.
And we will return with Zia Tamami after this one-minute pause on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside our area, please call 877-217-5757. Kevin Gallagher is producing. In a few moments, we'll hear from the author Van Mayhall, a Louisiana author, examining the role of Judas in a new thriller. But Zia Tamami will be at the Manship Theater tonight, along with a few hundred of his closest friends, to see the amazing Chucho Valdez, who a Cuban pianist, band leader, and composer, arranger. He'll be there, and it's something that is part of the River City Jazz Series that began 6 years ago. And I think it would be appropriate to mention Derek Gordon at
Absolutely.
This point.
Derek, we're going to miss him. He passed away September 10th of this year. We still feel his presence, and what a remarkable job he has done worldwide. He started with Lincoln Center Jazz Center as a CEO, and then Kennedy Center, and then we were lucky to have him here for the past 6-7 years. And what a transformation of Art Council, going from all directions, from the arts to music to programs in schools and workshops for the youngsters when some of these giants of jazz that are coming to town. We're really going to miss him, and he's definitely going to be missed.
These giants of jazz have been coming here for 6 years, and in large part because of their association with Derek. And who are some of the others who are
excited? Well, we have a wonderful group. Leo Hamilton is on board with us. Mr. Harry Anderson, who's the head of the Jazz Institute at Southern University. Dr. Bill Grimes, head of the Jazz Institute at LSU. C.J. Blush, Connie Lewis, and myself, and a couple of other colleagues. And this team is just wonderful. I mean, we all work together. It's a non-profitable organization, one of the premier in U.S. and North America.
And some of those will be coming after Chucho?
Oh, we have Jason Moran supposed to be here because of the flood in New York. He canceled, but he's going to join us again soon. Then December 13th, we have legendary Kenny Barron and world-renowned bass player Dave Holland. Thursday, February 7th, 2013, we have sax player James Carter and his group. And then Sunday, March 24th, we're going to have Monterey Jazz Festival 55th anniversary all-stars, including Dede Bridgewater, Christian McBride, Lewis Nash, and others. And then we're going to conclude Thursday, April 11th, with vocalist Jane Monheit. So we have an incredible lineup.
Nicholas on Corsi. Nicholas, you're on with Zia the Cat. Hi, Nicholas.
Morning, thank you. Yeah, I saw Branford Marcellus there a few years back. It was a wonderful show and a great program. I kind of like what I call fringe jazz, fusion, Pat Metheny, that type of thing. I was wondering what are the chances of getting that in, because I know you guys fall more under the kind of classic jazz form. But
well, I think Pat Metheny can fit in our format. We definitely shy away from any what they call smooth jazz and commercial jazz. But Pat Metheny definitely will be one to consider, and I think we're looking into hopefully booking some of these acts within the next season or so.
All right.
Definitely.
Jeff asked if smooth jazz is elevator jazz.
Well, you know, I mean, that's a name that really doesn't mean anything. They play they call it smooth jazz. They play R&B. They say smooth jazz. They play elevator music. You know, smooth jazz is just a commercial name that came. There is a cool jazz, which is very
and there's a cool cat.
Yes. Cool jazz.
Who I gather doesn't like smooth jazz.
You know, smooth jazz is it's good music as a background, but I don't look at it as an art form like true jazz.
Okay. Okay, Chucho de Valdez tonight, 7 and 9 at the Manship Theater. Just a few housekeeping items with Zia the Cat. You still drive around with that license plate?
No, my license plate was basically somebody took it twice, so I decided not to pursue with the cat anymore. As a matter of fact, I don't even mention that on the air, except you know some people they're still calling and mentioning that. But that's when we started 35 years ago.
Well, yeah, I mentioned Smiley, 33 years writing his column now, 33 and a half years. And Spontaneous Combustion has been heard on the LSU station for how long?
35 years.
35 years.
35 years.
That's about the time I met you, Zia.
Right, and I didn't know that. Dick LaPalme, Nat King Cole promoter, called me and said, Zia, I just want to let you know that you have the longest running jazz program in North America. And we do two shows on LSU and WBRH in one day, total of 8 hours, in excess of 125 selections. That's in one day. That's a lot of work.
35 years on WLSU, WPRG, KLSU, whatever the station happens to be known at the time. He has been there. I remember seeing him at East Stadium many years ago.
Oh, yeah. Those were the good old days.
And he's been doing it. He's the longest host in North America. You mean there's somebody in South America who's been doing it longer?
Well, maybe. There was a gentleman in Chicago who stopped broadcasting at the age
That's
of 81.
That's not South America.
No. But I'm saying that he had the longest running jazz show, and he retired about four or five years ago.
So Zia is now the longest lasting jazz host in North America and perhaps in the world.
God willing, maybe we can continue for a few more years.
Not bad from for a guy who came from Iran in what year?
1971. And I was blessed to see Dizzy Gillespie when I was 5 years old. Mm-hmm. So that's all starts with when mm-hmm. you're a little boy, you know.
All right. Well, I know where you'll be tonight at the Manship Theater. My guess is that you'll be having lunch at?
Well, absolutely. Yes. At Capitol Grill next door. That'd be a tradition to just relax and then get into the concert.
All right. Well, thank you, Zia.
Well, thank you for having me.
And we appreciate what you've done in this community.
Thank you.
Thank you. And we switch gears just a bit. Van Mayhall, senior partner in the Baton Rouge office of Brazil, Saxe & Wilson, and a man who's quite a barrister, who has taken on a target that few others have dared to discuss, Judas Iscariot. Good morning to you, Van Mayhall.
Good morning, Jim. How you doing?
Your book is Judas the Apostle. I remember when I was a kid in high school, and I went to a Catholic high school. Our principal, one time he called directory assistance in New York and asked if there were any Iscariots, and there were none. Judas is forgotten, perhaps for good reason, but why did you decide to do your book?
Well, I went through a faith journey a few years ago, Jim, and I read the Bible cover to cover, and I got to the part of Matthew where Matthew reports Jesus having said, "Better for the man who betrays me that he should never have been born." And I thought about that, and I thought about, well, what would happen if Judas had never been born? Probably would have been better for him. But what about the rest of us? What about the Christians and the salvation story? How would that have carried through? And it's a theological and philosophical loop that to which there's no answer, and that intrigued me and that caused me to look into it.
Well, what is most controversial about Judas Iscariot?
Well, I think there's no doubt that he betrayed Christ. All four of the Gospels detail that in the Garden of Gethsemane. But the question and the controversial issue is, why did he do it? Did he do it for the money, as the Orthodox Gospels suggest, or was there some other less apparent motivation?
What would that be?
Well, some people say that the word Iscariot, what we would call his last name, refers to a first century group of revolutionaries, the Sicarii, and that he was a member of that band, that he was a revolutionary bent on overthrowing the Romans, and that consequently he seized upon the relationship with Jesus, whom he thought was a God-sent Davidic-type king, to lead the Jews against the Romans. So some think that overthrow of the Romans through Jesus was his goal.
Do you think that?
It's hard to say. The expert, there are a lot more experts out there than me, and they're divided on it. I thought it was a fascinating and intellectual backstory to a novel. The novel is fictional. It's an international thriller, but because of the Judas backstory, it has an intellectual heft that you don't find in many of these type books.
The book is Judas the Apostle, from attorney and writer Van R. Mayhall, Jr., senior partner with Brazil, Saxe, and Wilson, and it's featured in the Barnes & Noble Rising Stars Special Collection. Now, few people realize that the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John disagree on the motivations of Judas. So why has there been some misconception on this?
Well, it's interesting. And actually, disagreement is one thing, but there's simply the absence of information. And what information there is in the four Gospels about Judas is very ambiguous. For instance, did you know that Judas was the treasurer of the public ministry of Christ? In other words, he's the guy who handled all the money. He received the contributions. He provided for the poor. He bought supplies. He must have been trusted with money at some level. Some experts have said, how likely is it that he would have betrayed Christ for a rather paltry sum?
Well, you have your theory as to why, but was this a sudden betrayal, or was it something that we should have known about Judas, or the apostles should have known about him?
Well, the Gospels say that Jesus always knew that Judas would betray him. But then again, that inconsistency. He chose Judas. Did he choose Judas in spite of that knowledge or because of that knowledge? There's just no answer.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's difficult to write a story about a historical figure who is well known, and as you note, in some cases maybe some ideas about Judas have not been correct, but it took some gumption to do this project, especially with your busy schedule as senior partner at Brazil Saxe. So why did you do it?
Well, again, the faith journey, I did it for that reason. I also felt like I wanted to write a novel. The novel involves issues of faith, of family, of Louisiana. There are great Louisiana scenes in it, from Madisonville, Louisiana, on the Chifuncta River, to LSU, then it moves on to Lyon, France, and the finale in Jerusalem. So it gave me the opportunity to explore all of these locations that I know and love, and I got some great characters in it. One of the things my...
Well, before we take a call or two, Chloe Lejeune.
Yeah.
What about Chloe?
Clotilde Lejeune, Madisonville, Louisiana, born and bred, becomes an ancient languages expert at the University of Washington, D.C. She's the heroine. She's a wounded but resourceful individual who comes back to bury her father, and she's thrown into this 2,000-year-old mystery about a relic inscribed with the name of Judas Iscariot.
297-5633 is your number if you'd like to talk with Van Mayhall. His book is a novel, but a novel with, of course, historical context, Judas the Apostle, Paul in Opelousas. Hi, Paul. Good morning to you.
How you doing, Jim? Good morning and happy Thanksgiving. Just a question to him. If Judas would not have died, would not have did what he did, and Christ would have lived, what would have happened? I think Judas was... His purpose was to do what he did.
Did he have a purpose to betray Christ and result in the crucifixion and resurrection of Jesus?
Well, it's a great question, Paul. What I want to see people do as a result of reading the book, is to go back and look at the Bible and make up your own mind. If Judas had not been there, how would God's plan have been achieved? One could conclude he was part of the plan.
Are you a man of faith?
Yes. Yes, I'm a cradle Catholic, and as a cradle Catholic, we didn't get much Bible reading, which is why I decided to go back and read it from cover to cover a few years ago.
There are people who believe this is all hocus pocus.
Well, hopefully they'll at least be entertained by the book, if not informed by it.
But in this country, we respect others who disagree with us. But when those of us, like you, who are Christian, there's a leap of faith involved here, isn't there?
Well, I think all faith involves a leap. But I think we can be informed. And again, I wanted to tell a good story, a thrilling story. But at the end of the day, I wanted people to say, I didn't see that coming. Let me pull out my Bible and see what it says.
So why does so few people, if any, name their kids Judas? I doubt that there's a Judas Mayhall out there.
Yeah, and as far as I know, there's not. But I think the reason is the taint, the historical story behind it. It's been a difficult thing. And why put your children through something like that?
But this is one of the most historic figures in world history.
Quite true. And the information that's known about him is very incomplete and ambiguous. My book fills in a few things, And my readers can do more. They can look at the book. And there's some other interesting characters in there. There's a Monsignor, or I like to think of a Monsignore from the Vatican. And what does he want, and has he come to help?
Right. Christina on Corsi. Christina, please be brief. You're on with Van Mayhall. Hi, Christina.
Hey, Jim. How are you doing?
Fine.
Listen, I remember reading a while back where it's in Luke 22, verse 3, where then Satan entered Judas, called Iscariot, one of the 12. So what happened was, at that point in time, Satan entered into Judas.
Well, if you read the book of John, the last book of the Gospels, you'll see that John recites that Satan entered into Judas when Christ handed him the slice of bread at the Last Supper, which is very interesting, since by that time Judas had already made his deal with the chief priests and elders. Once again, ambiguous and interesting information about Judas.
Well, the book is a novel from Van Mayhall, prominent attorney, Judas the Apostle. Best place to get a copy?
Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, iUniverse.com. It's all available.
Okay. Greg Langley of The Advocate says, Mayhall has a clear and uncluttered writing style, well-suited to the thriller genre. He created a bad guy who's truly evil. His plot is good. He does his homework on the history of the subject. Thank you, Van.
Thank you very much, Jim. Have a great Thanksgiving.
You too. We'll be back tomorrow. For Kevin Gallagher, I'm Jim Engster. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.